90% of all scientists that have ever been alive are alive today. That's a lot of information. But don't panic. It's not an exact science.
Hey, Shannon, how are you?
Try not to blow away, man.
You know, again, that's the theme of the last month.
I think so. Yeah, it's been windy here, really windy. I actually think it's been windy all year, not just all the storms that we've had here in the Midwest and particularly in Oklahoma. But we'll get to that, right?
Yeah, it has been weird, kind of wild with the storms that came through, because you know the future is different. I had a bunch of meat, had a brisket and some other things that we were cooking on our pellet smoker. And when the power went out, I ended up having to go out and put the smoker on a generator so I didn't spoil all this meat. So
I wish you were the only person.
2 a.m. in the PJs.
Exactly.
Starting the generator up.
There's no way that you're the only person that was doing that. That's all I have to say.
Oh, absolutely not. There are tons of late 30s people in my area, so the chance that I'm the only late 30s person that was smoking was low.
It was you guys doing that, and then the other half of the late 30s people were like, ugh, the light went out and I can't read my World War II history book.
Right.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's been an exciting week for sure. Yeah, we're getting ready to, despite that, we're getting ready to head off into the desert for sampling next week. So that will be very fun.
Yeah, you like to pack this part of your life very full, it seems. Maximize your travel, but also maximize the stress of that travel.
Oh, man, it's so true. So true. It is not. I am not a fun person to be around. I think my family would attest to that in like the last week of April, first couple of weeks of May. So, our field area that we're going to, this is about as early as you can get in. And so we're camping and I was looking and it's supposed to be 35 degrees. So, yeah, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. But, so no, that's other than the weather, I've just been kind of cranking along. We're gearing up because as you go into your busy time of year, so do we, because all the professors are getting freed up to think about research.
That's
and
right.
All the things that they wish they had ordered earlier in the year.
100%. I still have that list. I just can't get to it till July.
Yeah. So we're getting pretty busy right now. Had a lot of quote requests come in and getting started on some jobs. So it's been a little difficult to keep up my morning ritual, but so far I've been able to do it and have still been probably not getting 5 days a week of solid reading in the mornings, but several days anyway.
I want to tell you, I have stolen this from you as well.
Oh, really?
I have. Instead of waking up and going to my email, which I try not to do immediately, but more days than not, I do, right? So, like, while I'm making my coffee, I'm checking my email. Just checking, everyone. Don't get too excited. It's not like I'm actually working on it.
And you don't respond to emails during the day or in the morning.
That's exactly right. I just need to make sure nothing's on fire. And so I was like, no, you know what? And it feels really weird because I don't read for pleasure first thing in the morning. I read for pleasure in the evening. And it's awesome. Like, I finished 2 books since we last talked.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is great. But I want to hear about what you are reading.
Well, so I just finished one that I really, really enjoyed. And then I've started one that I had read partially when it came out. So the one that I'm reading now that I'd partially read was Adam Savage's Every Tool's a Hammer.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And I really like a lot of the ideas in it. it's kind of a modern shop class Soulcraft theme thing.
Oh, okay.
And some interesting things about him. So that one's been enjoyable. But what I finished right before it was Across the Airless Wilds. Which was one of those books that I was like, this is either going to be terrible and a slog or fascinating. And luckily it was fascinating and is the only book I've ever seen. And I have read a lot of space books. I mean, if it's a book on Apollo, I've probably read it.
Because you also smoke meat and are in your late 30s.
Right.
Carry on.
So this is a book entirely about the development, well, the early research into the development, contracting, completion, and use of the lunar rover.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Because yeah, everybody kind of just thinks, well, they may not even know whether we had that we had rovers.
Yes, correct.
What's more American than putting a car on the moon?
That's absolutely right. I mean, putting a McDonald's on the moon, that's next.
Yeah. So they had this car because they said, well, it's really hard to move around the spacesuits. They're basically big pressurized balloons. And it's hard to go very far. And they wanted to do geology. And it talks in there a decent amount about the geological training that the astronauts went through as well.
Oh, nice.
Which, if you want to hear some snippets on things about that, goes to our interview with Jim Head. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so you may not even know that we had rovers, or maybe know that that was a thing because you've seen some videos of it. This talked about how hard it was to do that. It doesn't sound hard, but it was
never
very
talk about
hard.
This. Yeah, that's something that doesn't get talked about at all. I mean, I've seen the lunar rover like in pictures, but yeah, I don't really think about it.
Like nobody probably really knows unless you've read this or really dug in. Like I knew that it was under or along the side of the lunar module and that they, you know, kind of dropped it onto the surface when they got there.
Mm-hmm.
It stored folded in a pie shape.
No, I didn't know that.
And they pulled these series of levers, and it would unfold and drop to the surface. And there's research on the traction and the wheel design that goes back to way before Apollo even, when Wernher von Braun was saying, well, we want to go to the moon and drive cars around on it one day. Some engineers that studied traction of like tracks and tires and all that thought, this is an interesting problem. How would we design a tire to go on the moon? And like, there was so much research in it, so many people, so many big problems.
For this thing that like we barely talk about now.
For this thing we barely talk about. And what I thought was cool about the book is it's kind of one of those everything's interesting if you look at it deeply enough.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of things where the author at the end was kind of like, look, the rover played in a very important part in what we know about the moon. Most of the very interesting samples we would not have if we hadn't been able to go far from the limb.
Oh, nice.
But this is just at the end of the day, you know, just in quotes, a car that was driven around for tens of miles at a time. And it's one tiny piece of the incredibly complicated thing that was flying to the moon.
Right.
And this still took hundreds of people and years.
That's unbelievable. So this is a silly question. Did we bring it back?
No, they're still there.
It's still there. Okay, cool.
Yep, they had a camera on them that could be remote controlled. I mean, they were only on the last three Apollo missions. The J missions, and so that's how we have the video of the limbs blasting off is the rover cameras.
Okay, gotcha.
But yeah, so, really interesting book. It talks like it gets into nerdy geology a little bit. At one point, it got into like why an Ackerman steering linkage was chosen, like deep into car stuff. It was just exceptionally well done. I don't know a lot about the author, but it was something that could have been incredibly dry, but mm-hmm. was presented in a really good chronological way. And he talked to basically everybody that was still alive.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So obviously I had to look this up immediately. And it said one of his reviews for a different book that he wrote that was about cars says a brilliant blend of shop class as soul craft and The Orchid Thief. I know you haven't read The Orchid Thief, but have you read Shop Class as Soul Craft?
Oh, yeah. That's why I compared it to it earlier.
That's
yeah.
what I thought. Okay. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought that you were a fan of that one. So.
I am. It's so, yeah. Earl Swift, if you want to come on the show anytime.
Let me finish reading this now. I got to put it on my list.
Yeah. So can't recommend that one highly enough. But what are you awesome. Reading right now?
Well, I just got finished with Atlantic by Simon Winchester. And so okay. I know we've talked a lot about Simon Winchester books on here. He's very into geology. What I learned, he had written this book called Pacific. It was all about the Pacific Ocean. I haven't read that one. But he wrote like Krakatoa and The Map That Changed the World, which is about the first geologic map and all of this. And so I picked up this Atlantic book. And it was really long, but my gosh. The main thing I learned is that Simon Winchester is the most interesting man in the world. And it wasn't about him. He reads the audiobook too, by the way, and he has the most brilliantly posh British accent, so it's wonderful. And it was like the first book I couldn't read sped up because he speaks so quickly in his posh British accent. I could only listen at like 1.1 instead of my normal sped up. And so it was, yeah, there's so much to say about it. But he was on some of the many of the scientific cruises, and including the ones in the 60s with like a bunch of paleo mag people figuring out plate tectonics and all of this stuff. He's been to every place you could go in Patagonia, all the crazy islands off of there. You know, he talks about washing up on an island essentially because their boat was broken. And he like knew the guy. He was like a Cambridge classmate of his that like was like the premier of the island or something. And it's like, what are you talking about? So really, that was like one of the more interesting aspects of it, was just this man's incredible career. Him having to eat this polar bear on this geologic expedition that he just went along for fun on in Antarctica. The word Arctic means bears, and Antarctic means no bears. Like, what?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like, I didn't know that. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, it comes from the Greek. Arctos, I think, is bear in Greek. So Arctic means bears, and Antarctic means no bears.
Well, that was
amazing.
Not the right guess.
Nope. Uh-huh. So crazy. So, yeah, it was a very interesting book. Interesting enough that I just listened to the app, and I went ahead and started The Professor and the Madman, which is a book that he's written about how the Oxford English Dictionary got made. And it is spectacularly amazing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. I learned a word that I've used a couple of times. The sesquipedarianism or something, and it just means using a lot of jargon, so I kind of love it. It means using very long words when shorter words could do. Sesquipedalian, that's what it is.
That's amazing.
It is super amazing. So those are my most recent ones that I've been pretty excited about.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and we've had a lot of time to read, because, you know, spending a lot of time watching the TV in the background and watching all these storms.
I mean, There, you know, we said there's nothing more American than putting a car on the moon. There's nothing more Midwest than like standing on the front porch, looking outside with the local weather person talking in the background and a no weather radio going off.
That is exactly right. Yep. It's been a lot. I can't imagine being a TV weather person. I worked in a interned in a TV weather station for a couple of summers, like my last year in high school and stuff. And it was a trip. It's a very interesting environment. And our local weather people have been on nearly nonstop. And I don't think there are other places in the country where you could get away with this. Right?
Like, no, definitely not. Everybody would be angry that they're missing their... I don't know what's a popular TV show right now. I haven't watched... For me, TV stopped in about 2010.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I don't... Is NCIS still on? Like NCIS season 900 or something?
I'm sure it is. And CSI...
CSI Moon.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So they were on... I mean, they started at 9:30 in the morning, which is weird, right? We don't have that kind of early morning tornado issues, generally. Every once in a while, yes. But it feels like it usually happens, like, later on in May. Not this early.
Yeah, I mean, you need to be able to get that convective energy up.
Yeah.
Before you can get storms going, and that just doesn't happen early in the day, this early in the year.
Exactly. And they did not exit the airwaves till after 11 p.m., because there were still tornadic storms in our area at that time.
It was crazy.
It was. And, like, I mean, it's one thing to be like, man, this is crazy. I'm getting sick of these storms. But the other thing that I think about a lot is, you know, obviously we both got meteorology degrees. And so both of our spouses have quite a bit of meteorological knowledge, whether they want it or not, right? And so... You know, my husband is like, oh, so this is going to be like the normal setup. They're going to start here and then pop up along the dry line. And I had to be like, well, no, that's not what's happening, actually. This is kind of a totally different setup. It's not convective forcing. So usually, like you just said, John, like it gets really warm and you wait for the storms to like pop up through the cap and all that jazz, the cap to erode off, which just meaning it's getting cool enough in the upper atmosphere to let big storms happen. And that's sort of a normal, quote unquote, severe weather setup. But these were driven by this really strong jet stream that came down, and it was windy all day. And I feel like sometimes in the Midwest, you can wake up and you just know it's going to be a severe weather day. It just feels really humid. You know the days, right? Exactly. Yeah. Except for it was like 30-mile-an-hour winds all day. And then we got these weird tornadic storms. They were all moving kind of north. And then the next round, a couple of days later, they were kind of stationary. They weren't really moving at all. They were just sitting there cycling and dumping tons of rain. And it's just been a really... unsettling and not familiar weather pattern, I feel like.
I agree. And every year we at some point just put our head in our hands on some of the stuff that we hear being reported.
Yes.
About storms.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So generally in this area of the country, the TV weather folks do a decent job.
Yes,
and absolutely. I even dare say, excellent job.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
They are used to dealing with these kind of systems. Mm-hmm. But especially in national news, it's just abysmal. Or in people saying words that they've heard the weather people say. And, you know, you and I are both used to hearing some chaser slang, right?
Yes, exactly. Yep.
But there's some new ones to add to the Chaser Slang Urban Dictionary, apparently.
So one of the things that I teach in native science class is we talk about the Thunderbird, which obviously seems like a weather thing, right? And it's like the Thunderbirds aren't always weather related, but obviously they have some aspect of of weather related. And so the professor that I learned this stuff from, that you and I both had, Dr. Kevin Klazel, he talks about the Thunderbird. And if you think about that shape, right, like the eagle with his like wings out, right, you can kind of make it look like a supercell. If you're thinking about a supercell that has like an overshooting top and that's a little eagle's head and then the anvil, yeah. Right? And the anvil spreads out and it's his wings and then like the lightning or like the feathers coming down from the wings or something like that.
Okay, so that sure, yeah.
That I've heard. This thing that keeps getting talked about on our local weather station, he keeps calling these storms. He says, "I see the screaming eagle." have you ever? I have never heard of this. And he would be looking at the radar and say, "Classic screaming eagle." I have never heard this.
That sounds like something he had to be saying on a bet almost. Like, I've never heard that in my life.
So I haven't heard it in my life either. And so obviously I turned to Google and I found it. I found it. So this is describing what, like, the radar reflection, and it says particularly in the mid-levels, of a forward flank notch. Does that even sound familiar to you?
I mean, I guess it's forward flank downdraft clearing from substance is what it sounds like.
So this thing that I found actually shows a picture of the May 3rd tornado, the 1999 very famous tornado that came through Oklahoma City. And it shows this screaming eagle. And so it looks more like, every time you said it, I thought my kids were going to, they're like, is Angry Birds on?
Right.
And I was like, his name was Mighty Eagle, but I understand where you're coming from, right? And so this picture on this website shows this forward flank notch. And yeah, it's, they talk about it being that area where you have that. It says flow interacts with a strong and persistent updraft. You get Bernoulli acceleration on the flanks of a storm with a strong updraft. And the forward flank notch is not the same as the inflow notch because that's at low levels and the forward flank notch is at associated with the mid-level updraft.
Okay.
I hadn't heard this. I mean, I guess I see it. I don't necessarily see the screaming eagle part of it as much, but I could. I
also don't see the need to not just say forward notch.
Forward flank notch. Or even just saying a notch, right? Like, look at this notch in the mid-levels. Because what does notch mean? You just said that. When we're talking about weird radar terms, you hear that word a lot, but it kind of means the absence of a thing instead of, you know, a thing. It's indicating what?
There's no hydrometeors there.
Exactly. Because that's what the radar is seeing, right? Or hail or whatever. It's seeing things in the air. And so that notch is just the absence of. And so I guess if you take a supercell on the radar and you kind of put a notch in the forward flank of the supercell, it looks like wings. That's all I can figure out about this classic screaming eagle that keeps getting talked about.
Interesting. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't love the nicknames for things so much, but mm-hmm. especially because one thing that amazed me when I lived not in this part of the country was how well-versed everybody here is in terms of meteorology.
Yes, 100%. When we lived in Iowa or even in Denver, people would be like, "What do you mean when you guys sat around and, you know, played bingo with the with these, like, weather?" We have weather bingo. We have a little bingo card that has these sort of terms on it, and that's what you do in May in Oklahoma. Just no one else does this, right? Like, so whenever they say stuff like screaming eagle, you put your little bingo marker on, and maybe you'll win, because they're on the television quite a lot. And what I enjoy, though, is them explaining these things to the public. But you're right, it gets a little, like, chaser slangy, and so, therefore, it's harder for people to understand, I think.
Right. But, I mean, people do know a lot. Like, in Oklahoma, you can talk about the dry line, and 95% of Oklahomans are going to know exactly what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
Yep. But, yeah, Screamin' Eagle, I doubt, has that kind of following.
Yeah, I didn't think so. So that one was a weird one. And I thought we'd just talk about sort of the rest of the weird ones or just things that you hear this time of year. And so, like, another chaser slang one that I also don't love. And I worked at the Severe Storms Laboratory. I drove, like, the chaser vehicles that were the research grade chaser vehicles. And I hadn't heard this one either. Tail End Charlie.
Oh, I heard this one a lot.
Okay, yeah. I think this one came about a little past my time, back when the internet was making chasing a lot easier.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this is just the last storm, right?
Yeah, it's the last storm that's forming along whatever boundary is forcing the convection to happen. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It seems to me that there's a lot of, like, oh, well, that means it's going to get more energy. Or, I don't know, there seems to be lots of kind of crackpot things floating around about.
Yeah.
You want to hang out for the tail end, Charlie. Now, there are some interesting things about being the last storm. Like, you're not ingesting, well, you're moving into maybe a slightly less modified environment.
Mm-hmm.
From right. all the preceding stuff. So, like, there is something to it's a different storm. Mm-hmm. And Tail End Charlie, here, let's bring it full circle to our discussion in the first, comes from World War II tail gunners.
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I assumed that's exactly what it came from. So that's kind of a radar thing, but also, you know, the chaser thing, too. And... yeah. Did you have any other weird ones that you would hear a lot?
Not really any other weird ones. Lots of people talking about, like, rear flank downdraft that didn't know necessarily what they were looking at.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is always interesting when, yes, or people start to talk about the gust front, which is different from inflow. So we've had a lot of those confusions lately, I feel like, you know. We've had a lot of easterly winds as these winds are coming in, and that's the inflow getting sucked into the wind. And so I've heard people say, oh, man, this is a pretty big gust front. I'm like, nope, gust front is going out of the storm. Inflow is going into the storm. But just the fact, you're exactly right, like just the fact that people know those words is kind of cool.
It's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, there is that definite sense of, like, it's going to be a bad day because yes. you've been around enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know you're going to love this. Juicy.
Oh, absolutely. That's the word. And everyone, like, is texting that. Everyone's like, man, it is juicy outside.
I mean, I'm just saying it's not a coincidence that juicy and joules per kilogram, the unit for cape, are very similar. Because they're semi-synonymous.
Oh, completely. That is absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. Yep. When you're on that end of the dry line, the juicy end, that's when right. you got to worry.
So, yep. But what about some of the things, you know, a lot of people don't look at radar a lot. They're not comfortable yes. looking at radar. You and I look at radar all the time, even in not bad weather, because sometimes we're looking at cool things like super refraction, where we can see reflections off cars on the interstate.
Mm-hmm. Or yep, exactly.
Birds which is absolutely... after an earthquake.
Yes, yeah, grasshoppers stuck in little vorticity rolls. Yes, that is exactly right. Right, and so there's all these shapes that go along with looking at radar. And it was interesting. It was a couple of years ago now where there was a big derecho that went through Cedar Rapids. We had a show about it. And it was interesting to hear all of the people up there say just what you said. They're just like, I've never heard that word, derecho. Like, that's really weird, isn't it? And it's like, well, no, it wasn't actually weird. Like, it happened at a time when these storms happen. Wasn't a strange storm. It was a particularly strong one, yes. And so I feel like anyone here would know what, like, a bow echo is, and that's all it was.
Right, and that's where the line of storms bows out because of all the downdraft.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. And, I mean, that's a different setup, but we actually had a few tornadoes last week that came from storms within that sort of bow echo that was coming across. And I always found that those are sort of the easiest to identify by the presence of their beware.
Their beware? What's their beware?
Their bounded weak echo regions.
Okay, so that is the opposite of Screaming Eagle. That's a very science definition.
Yes, exactly. So it's not a Pokemon.
What does that look like?
And so this is not a Pokemon, like I said. It's the same thing you said. It seems like all the interesting parts of these big storms are in the absence of the hydrometeors, right? And so the weak echo region is the part of the storm where you're not seeing any of the hydrometeors or hail or anything like this, because this is where you're actually bringing in inflow to that part of the storm, and it could turn into a hook echo at that point.
Right, and the hook echo is kind of the classic, this is what tornadoes look like on radar. Mm-hmm. It's a storm with a hook.
Right.
And I think it's kind of the one that was easiest to identify early on in the days of radar. Now everybody in the weather service is excellent at understanding radar images. We've got a lot of experience with radar images, but they are complex because you're getting a weird kind of 2D, but not really 2D. It's sloping 2D plan view of a complicated space.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to understand. So you start developing these patterns that you look for.
Right, that's exactly. So it's much easier to see like a beware in a cross section of the radar, which is not something you frequently get if you're watching the TV. Sometimes they'll do so. So the local one that we like to watch a whole lot, the local weatherman, meteorologist, not weatherman, definitely takes these vertical cross sections of storms. And that's where you see this beware, which is this inflow, but then everything else is on top of it. And so it's just kind of little notch.
Do you remember the radar term for those? Scan up and down instead of spin around?
Oh, when you're scanning up and down.
In his case, it's being done with software post-fact.
Yes,
but
correct.
If you've got a radar, you can either spin around at a fixed elevation, or you can point in one direction and scan up and down. And those are called two different things.
Yep. Nope. I'm going to betray my radar meteorology class right now.
So it's RHI for scanning up and down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There we go. Yes.
And PPI for the map view. Plan
that's
position.
That's exact. Plan position. That's it. Yes. I will say that radar has changed quite a bit. I was certainly around when we were still looking at WSR 88D radar, and now we have dual pole radar, which has introduced a whole lot of different things that you can see. But one thing that exists in both of them, and you're exactly right, the way radar works, right? As soon as you get far enough away, you're not following the curvature of the earth, and so the far off stuff is further up in the storm. And as we found out just the other night when we had a tornado go right next to the radar operations center here in Norman. It's really hard to see things that close to the radar. You would think that you're like, oh, you're close to the radar. That'll be a really great image. And it's not at all, because it's not seen very high up into the storm.
The cone of silence.
The cone of silence. Which is the best part of the first Twister, when they're looking up at the storm outside and he say the cone of silence.
Yes.
Which is a radar term, not a... Yeah, it was amazing. I got to see Twister and they played it at the IMAX theater in the Science Museum, and NSSL got invited to it, and it was a riot. Let me tell you.
Oh, I bet.
It felt like being in a real life MST3K. Like, yeah. That was one of the ones that collected the biggest amount of groans, for sure. Yeah.
So when you're looking, assuming the storm's far enough away from the radar, you get the hook echo, and mm-hmm. that's indicating that there's reflections that are curling around, and that's mm-hmm. a curl should hint that this is a vector thing.
Yes.
But to do that, we need to have wind moving in different directions, because that's how we get spin mm-hmm. or vorticity.
Exactly. So I think most of the things we've been talking about are definitely seen better in reflectivity. So just the radar energy bouncing off of a thing that's out there and coming back. But you can also tell the directions things are flowing. And so as you're looking at the velocities, so they'll pull up the velocities. Usually it's that red and green radar screen that comes out. When we're talking about tornadoes, you're looking at one little velocity that's going away from the radar and one that's going to it, and that's next to each other on the little scans. And so that indicates rotation, and that's your velocity couplet. And so you'll hear them saying a lot, you know, there's a velocity couplet here, which means you have rotation.
Look for the miscolored Pepsi symbol.
That's exactly right.
And if you want to know what direction the wind's going, if it's red, remember this is all radar relative, because all relative to the radar beam. If it's red, it's like taillights. It's going away from the radar.
Oh,
it's
green, there you go.
It's coming towards you.
That's a good one. Now, these are next to each other. If you're looking along one, like, sort of beam of the radar, that would be something like a downburst, and then they have to be next to each other to be rotation. But you can see these velocity couplets. Like, you can see the tornado in this velocity couplet if it's at the lowest level of the radar. And then you can see what we would call the mesocyclone, right? Or the, like, the spinning part of the big supercell. You would see this in the upper levels. So you can see these rotations throughout the storm.
Right. And if you are very close, or, well, very might be, if it's a very large tornado or it's relatively yes. close to the radar,
mm-hmm. yes,
it's lofting debris into the air, and that's something that the radar reflects off of also, and you get this very characteristic-looking small donut in the crook mm-hmm. of the hook, and that's called the debris ball.
Right, exactly. So this tornado debris signature, which I think is something interesting. We didn't talk about that a lot back in the day. And I think like May 3rd, 1999 tornado was so big that, I mean, it's, you know, the 25th anniversary, which is really weird to think of about that it was so big that it was debris that you were seeing in the radar. It wasn't just hydrometeors, it wasn't just hail, it wasn't just the actual, you know, condensation that makes up the tornado. It was like houses and stuff. And so ever since then, they look for these little debris balls or these tornado debris signatures in some of them. And unfortunately, we saw a few of those this week when, like, Sulphur, Oklahoma got hit directly. You could see these little debris signatures as well in the radar, which is awful.
Yeah, if you see that, it's pretty much a sure sign there's a tornado on the ground and it is doing significant amounts of destruction.
Right, exactly. I don't know if you've talked to anyone about this, John. It seems like the Weather Service has a lot of different things they do now Like, now there's not just these warnings, but they're very explicit in the warnings, right? And so I've noticed, so now we have these special, not, it's kind of a special weather statement, but they come out in, like, areas saying, hey, look, these storms aren't severe. Here's this area, though, that maybe you need to pay attention to because they might be severe. So that comes out, like, as a warning, or, you know, the same way you receive warnings. And then there's still the severe thunderstorm warning. And then they have the tornado warning, obviously. But the tornado warnings are frequently start from these radar indications that we've been just talking about. Usually these velocity couplets or these really well-defined hook echoes. And they say tornado, or they say radar indicated rotation. And so they put this
nobody's just a tornado warning on the ground.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it could be there.
Exactly. But then they also designate now that the tornado emergency situation. And that's when you've got eyeballs on it.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if this is like a thing that all the weather services do now. I imagine it probably is because I've been watching an awful lot of them, it seems like. So that's something that I don't know if always happened, but I've definitely been paying attention to that. So there are kind of like degrees within the warnings to be like, look, the radar says this looks like there could be a tornado, but we don't know yet, versus 100% there's a person there, eyeballs on it, tornado happening.
Right.
Because just like you said, right, you get off of the ground pretty quickly the farther you go away from the radar. So rotation at the 1,000 meter mark doesn't mean tornado, even though it's rotating.
Yeah, I mean, and tornadoes aren't really that tall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In terms of the atmosphere. They're just not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not at all. I love those like schematic drawings of supercells because you're like, man, that's a big storm. And then always there at the little bottom under the tiny wall cloud is a tiny little bitty tornado.
Right, this whole storm.
Yeah.
Working to generate enough vorticity to concentrate down into one little tornado. So, I mean, most tornadoes are a couple thousand feet.
Mm-hmm.
5,000 feet's really kind of the tops.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just not super tall. Now, they can get very wide. They can be as wide as they are tall or wider.
Right, yeah, exactly. That El Reno storm here was, what, like 2 miles wide or something crazy like that?
Yeah. And for reference for people that don't speak King's feet, it's a half a kilometer to a kilometer and a half tall, roughly.
Yeah, so that's pretty big. We had the tornado that came through Norman just a couple of days ago. Was pretty small. Tore the roof off the gas station. It actually hit the airport. I think it tore up a hangar door. And then the airport chain link fence, it just had that tornado look. Do you know what I'm saying? With like leaves stuffed in it.
The disheveled.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. From pieces of 2x4 whacking into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what it looked like. But that was, I don't know what the official thing was, but that one was, I don't know, tens of meters across, if that. So yeah, the different, and you know, this is going back to Chaser speak a little bit. There's kind of a very funny like tornado morphology language, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so like these big ones, you generally talk about it wedging, right? It's a wedge. But almost always when it starts, our local guy screams, rope on the ground.
Which, I mean, that's when they dissipate, they go to ropes commonly too.
Yep, exactly. And then you say it's roping out.
What's a rope tornado? Watch Wizard of Oz. That's rope.
That is exactly right. These all sound like, now it feels like we're in a rodeo. stovepipes? There have been an awful lot of stovepipes lately.
Mm-hmm. These are my favorite tornado to photograph.
Really?
Yes.
Hmm. And so they're just, The same diameter all the way. Is that why? Is it geometrically appealing to you?
It's geometrically pleasing, yes. Also, it doesn't look like it should do that.
No, not at all. I think they look so fake.
And physics-wise, it's like, what? Like, there's drastically different drag and inflow and vortex. Like, what?
How is it all the same? How is friction not affecting the shape of this tornado? Mm-hmm. I feel like there's been some really tall stovepipe tornadoes, too. Some of these pictures from Nebraska and Iowa in the past couple weeks. Yeah, they're very, very tall stovepipes. The wedge, like May 3rd, 99 is what I always think of when I think of wedge tornado, right? Just very classic wedge shaped. But the same Screaming Eagle guy has thrown out a lot of elephant trunks lately, too.
So is this more like just classic funnel shape?
I guess so. I said, what? Like, why? Why is it? It's in between. It's just a bigger rope, but it's not quite a wedge. That's all I figured out. I heard it three times today looking at the tornadoes in the Texas panhandle. I heard elephant trunk. Yeah. So that's what I could gather. It's not real big. It's not a stovepipe. It's a little bit wider at the top, but not a lot. So, yes, draw a tornado. Probably an elephant trunk.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't have any more. Those were all that I had really used or heard of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And just one comment that I will make on this. I have seen a post talking about the radar signature of the Southern Oklahoma tornado. Mm-hmm. And though the tornado, I don't know exactly how tall it was, but you know, we're saying these tornadoes aren't typically that tall from cloud base to ground. That storm had hook-like features and very clear circulations to 18,000 feet.
Oh my gosh.
It's one of the deepest circulations that we've seen in a long time. It's going to be a lot of master's and PhD work going on to this one.
Man, that's what I always think. That's what I always think. I'm like, that's at least 4 master's theses. Every time I see one of these storms, this is exactly what I think of. So you and I both have visited many of those master's defenses that are about certain ones of these storms. Yeah. I mean, that's almost half the troposphere. That's getting up there.
That is. That's a terrifyingly deep circulation. That's my gosh. The momentum involved is incredible.
Yeah, there are still weird things happening out there in terms of these storms recently, too, because, like, there have been anticyclonic tornadoes.
I've seen a couple of those before, and that was pretty weird.
Me too. It is weird. And I guess if you probably ask most people, they would make the correct direction of motion when talking about a tornado, which is counterclockwise.
In the Northern Hemisphere, we get cyclonic tornadoes.
I'm sorry, yes, I am very self-centered. Yes, we have cyclonic tornadoes, right?
In Australia, the tornadoes are upside down.
Mm-hmm, like completely.
So wide at the ground, narrow at the top.
Elephant on its back.
Daryl, go ahead and correct us on that one.
He can't prove it. So we've had some anticyclonic tornadoes too. There was one storm that like cycled between like the cyclonic one came down and then the anticyclonic part came down. Because you can't spin one way and not have an equal and opposite spin. So somewhere up there, it's spinning the opposite way. But usually that part doesn't become the tornado. But sometimes it does.
And then we could talk about right and left movers. And
Oh man, that is always true. Right movers are bad, right? That's kind of what
getting into some deep dynamics there.
Which is a whole nother story, but...
It really is. As you know, you said, well, dual poles changed a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And it has. And if anybody's interested, I will link in... Matt Cumgen's got a great... It's, let's see, 2013... Principles and Applications of Dual Polarization Weather Radar, Part 1, Description of the Polarimetric Radar Variables. And it is a 17-page paper that goes through every dual pole variable, what it is, what it means, how it's derived. It's an excellent read.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, I think maybe we should potentially even talk about that next time, because I was leaving meteorology and picked geology right at the time period when dual pole was sort of coming online. And so a lot of my knowledge is antiquated, and they keep using things like correlation coefficients and all of this jazz. And I had to like look up what that's correlating, but I would love to hear more about dual pole stuff. Maybe in more depth
Maybe we can do a whole show on that.
Yeah, that sounds great. Is there a whole bunch more jargon in dual pole related stuff?
Oh, of course.
Excellent. That's what I love.
And the same thing called different things by different people? You bet.
Oh, okay. That's even better.
So, but now I think we should talk about a different kind of explosive growth in this week's Fun Paper Friday.
Yay. Isn't this weird?
This is very weird. This is called Death Squared, The Explosive Growth and Demise of a Mouse Population by John B. Calhoun, M.D.
Which, that sounds like the most awesomely, like, normal doctor name ever.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I found this gem deep in a Reddit, and this is Proceedings of the Royal Society of Medicine from 1973.
Mm-hmm. This is a very interesting, slightly bizarre, and slightly disturbing paper.
It's so weird, mostly because of the weird waxing about, I don't know, there's a lot of Bible quotes in it.
Yeah, there's like, there's a lot of revelations.
Yeah. Yeah, like, it immediately, I was like, this is amazing. We're absolutely talking about this. I mean, the first sentence, I shall largely speak of mice, but my thoughts are on man, on healing, on life and its evolution. Like, immediately, I'm hooked. Right?
Yeah, so it does get pretty philosophical.
Outrageously philosophical, but with the weirdest experimental setup, too.
This is one of those experiments that, like, if somebody was like, did you hear about this guy in the 70s that did blah, 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 blah with mice? I would have gone, oh, really? The whole time thinking, this person's insane.
Exactly.
This never happened.
Exactly. But, you know, they got this paper out of it, so I'm sure it's fine. Since that's the only way we measure academics.
He built this giant mouse habitat that he in fact calls the mouse universe.
That creeps me out immediately. Mm-hmm.
And also, did you notice what symposia this issue was on?
Oh, huh?
The Symposium on Man in His Place.
That's right.
A very, like, 70s philosophical title.
Yeah, I saw that on that first, on that second page, and it's above that, the creepy picture of the universe. And I thought, oh man, this is awesome. And he goes on, he talks about in Revelation, like, this is his whole setup in terms of his experimental question. And he talks about the two deaths, right? Death of the spirit and death of the body. And there are like four paragraphs about this. And then I guess he thinks about this in terms of like ecological ways that you can die. And then just decides to make this mouse universe without these things, or seeing how these things affect this large body of mice that he creates in this weird universe.
Yeah, so what happens to a population if you remove all threats?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No immigration, no research, resource shortage.
Mm-hmm.
No inclement weather, no disease, no predation. What's going to happen?
I think I will say he, those five things, he directly relates to the ways you can die as revealed in Revelation by the sword, by famine, by pestilence, or by wild beasts.
Right.
It was a stretch, but also he explained it very well, and so I'm on board.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't understand why the Revelation connection, that didn't why make not? The paper any less fascinating.
It definitely hooked me, though. I probably wouldn't have read about this otherwise. If I saw this picture, I would have, yeah. But
So this is, he made this bizarre.
Oh my gosh.
universe that was like 100 and something inches on a side, I think.
101 inches, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty tall. Mice could climb up in the universe, but not out. And there were different sections of the universe that they could live in, different levels. There was abundant. They never had to want for food or water or nesting materials. It was all always taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So then what happens, right? You start this bizarre experiment, and what you would expect to happen happens immediately, right? There's explosive initial population growth.
Yeah, and so he got these very healthy laboratory-grade mice and started with just a few pair. And, yeah, got exponential population growth.
Right, yeah. He started with 8 mice. That was it.
Yeah, and I'm trying to find the... Okay, yeah. So the progression numbers were approximately 20, 40, 80, 160, 320, and 620. So in 5 doublings, we're at crazy. 600 mice.
That's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a lot of mice. But that's, he does these calculations and says, look, like, depending on how you want to say it's limited, if we limit the population by food or water, that would be 9,500 or 6,100 mice. If we talk about housing limitation, it's over 3,800. He does all this math to say, look, the universe is big enough. Mm-hmm. It's not, resource constraint is not what causes what happened to the population to happen.
Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, after the first explosive growth, then we enter a more lax growth phase.
Mm-hmm. Right. I actually didn't realize how short mice lifespans are. I don't know how long I...
short.
Yeah, I don't know how long I thought they lived, but he was talking about them living, numerous ones lived into 800 days. Was it that? Was it 800 days or 600 something days? It was somewhere a little over 2 years. And that was the equivalent of living into your 80s as a human.
Yeah, I think it was 800 days was 80s, roughly.
Yeah, yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, then we get this clustering of the females and brood groups, which is interesting, and they organize themselves geometrically very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, you can kind of see that in this grainy picture, which is really weird. Because he talked about, that was an interesting point to me, talking about the nesting boxes. And how they would overpack into them, and also how, like, herd mentality is, or something like that. So almost everybody could just, basically, you didn't have to all eat out of the same food bowl, but the food bowls were big enough they could, and so more likely than not, there were groups eating together, or there were groups drinking together, or groups living together that seemed unusually large.
When there were open, unused habitats, yeah, or drinkers, mm-hmm, or food bowls.
Yeah, in this figure, like, you can see just a ton of mice at a couple of the food bowls, but a ton of them were open, but they don't go to those. That's weird.
And then we start seeing that the number of, I did not know this, baby mice are called pups.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I didn't know that.
I had a grad student that kept mice, so that's the only reason I know it.
So in this experiment, which was Universe 25, the pup production per brood group decreases linearly with the generation of pups.
That's very linear, too. Anybody could draw this line.
Yeah, yeah. This is like the what is a linear fit 101
yeah!
graph.
It's pretty impressive. And this is a natural experiment, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and the way they were keeping track of certain mice was by color coding them.
Of course.
But anyway, so yeah, then they get this inhibited secondary population growth, mm-hmm. or the stagnation phase that happens after we get this slowdown.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so now we're not even close to doubling. We have started to level out, if not decrease a little bit, but not much yet, right? And so how long did this, a little over a year in, and it continued for almost a year, is when we're in this phase.
Yeah, so it says day 560, population increase abruptly ceased.
Yeah.
Mothers were abandoning pups. The mice were starting to fragment in their little social cliques. So not a weird. Good sign for the population.
Mm-hmm. They even have recorded, gosh, these poor lab assistants, the last conception was around day 920.
Yeah, it says, for all practical purposes, there had been a death of the societal organization by the end of phase C.
So weird.
And okay. Then we go into the death phase, phase D.
Yeah.
Where now we're not growing, we're not maintaining, we're declining.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so like I just said, 920, nobody's doing anything anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unbelievable.
And what was interesting was they said, well, there's too many mice for too few social roles.
Hmm.
So there wasn't a place for, you know, George, or whatever we want to call our mouse. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a place for him in society. All the roles were filled.
This is so scary.
So, actually, what does George do? George loafs. George doesn't pick up any skills. He doesn't contribute to the population. He becomes a loner. And his behavioral repertoire is largely confined to eating, drinking, sleeping, and grooming, none of which carried any social implications beyond that resented by the contiguity of bodies.
So creepy.
Right? Yeah. It talks about, you know, they're not going out and finding partners and making pups. Sometimes they would squabble with each other, but not, again, not really do much. And later on, they said they even had the male counterparts to non-reproducing females were then dubbed the beautiful ones, as they never engaged in sexual approaches towards females, so they never engaged in any fighting, and they had no wound or scar tissue. Thus, they remained in excellent condition. Because they talked about how earlier in the phase C, some of the males, when there weren't enough dominant male slots, but too many males, basically all the males were scarred up and just eating each other all the time.
Right, yeah, exactly. Oh, my gosh.
So he says the results should be considered. Customary causes of mortality become markedly reduced in any species, mammal, whose members form societal groups, reduction of bodily death, yada, yada. Basically saying this is something humans should pay attention to. Look for the breakdown of normal social establishment and organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the output of that is the spiritual death, not the body death, because none of these mice, they weren't being predated. They didn't have diseases. they just died of not having a job. So weird.
For an animal so complex as man, there is no logical reason why a comparable sequence of events should not also lead to species extinction. If opportunities for role fulfillment fall far short of the demand of those capable of filling the roles and having experience to do so, only violence and disruption of social organization can follow.
Mm-hmm.
That should send some chills.
Yeah, yes, exactly. He goes on to talk about like the jobs and everything, right? And saying that the loss of these complex behaviors in the society means death of your species. Yeah. And then he quotes the Bible again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if John B. Calhoun is still alive, but I bet he passes out this paper to everyone he meets.
Right? With something along the phrase of, I told you.
Exactly. Like, I thought it was going to be funny at first because that's a ridiculous universe of mice. And then I was like, ooh, this is like dark funny. And then it's right. Like uncomfortably, you know, Idiocracy funny.
Yeah. Which in itself is becoming almost a documentary. So,
exactly. That is exactly right. So there we go.
Yeah. Well, if you want to
send
in,
I'll stay off of Reddit.
Results of your mouse universe.
Please don't.
Or anything else. And, you know, I should point out before we go, we have received a couple of listener emails.
Excellent.
One was from Abe Klein, reiterating to me that RAID is not a backup and triple backup theory is a thing. Which, yes, and I've become more and more lazy with the cloud, which is my own fault. I almost paid the price for it, so good point. I need to...
Yes.
Need to get back to my multiple horcruxes of backup data like I had in grad school.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure we did at least three shows about that.
Yep. And says, finally, as a lifelong resident of Iowa City, he appreciates your shout-outs.
Oh, yay. That makes me very happy.
And then we also had an email from Eric. And Eric says he's been listening for quite a while, a couple years, as he discovered that he had a passion for geology and has been researching a lot about where he lives, which is New Jersey. And it's done a presentation, which I thought this was my favorite since the email. I've done a whole talk for my scout troop on the geologic history of New Jersey. Now, granted, I was the only person who wasn't yawning by the end of it. I doubt that. You've got a lot of good geology up there.
Yeah, exactly. I feel that way every time I lecture, so I hear you, Eric.
And he says he goes out and looks at outcrops, logs them, and sounds like he's on a great path to do just about anything in the natural sciences.
Yeah, spectacular.
So keep making observations, Eric, and thanks for listening. But if you would like to send anything in to us, or maybe tell us what we're not doing, making proper backups. We always do love to hear from you, Shannon. How can they get a hold of us?
Don'tpanicgeocast@gmail.com. You can find us on X. I'm at Shannon Doolin. Sean is at @geo_Lehman. Together we are at Don't Panic Geo. And as always, thanks to our Patreon supporters. If you would like to support us on Patreon, you may do so. Patreon.com/Don'tPanicGeo.
And until next week, remember, don't panic.
It's not an exact science.
Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed are solely ours and do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers or funding agencies.